Our text for this evening is Psalm 15. And as you're turning there, the question really is, can you come as you are? Talking about worship, what are the rules for worship? And certainly there's more of that than we could deal with in a single devotional. And I'm not talking so much about how worship is done. That's a issue for another day. But the right to come to worship, the right to be here on Sunday morning and approach God in worship. You know, in Exodus 3, Moses was told to remove his shoes because he was on holy ground. There were some rules in play so that Moses could approach the very presence of God. Does it matter what our heart attitude is as we approach worship? Does it matter what our lifestyle is as we approach worship? Or may we just freely come as we are? Which is sort of the mantra of the day, come as you are. And sometimes that is a reference to how one dresses when they come to worship. But I think there's a broader question here, and it's one we have to address. May we bring our deceit, our pride, our anger, and our lust before God and our worship and expect that the worship will be acceptable. Psalm 15 in verse 1 opens with the question, Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? And who shall dwell in thy holy hill? This looks like a rhetorical question, but as you read the rest of Psalm 15, it becomes apparent it's not merely a rhetorical question because it has an answer provided. The question that's asked is, who may enter into the presence of the Lord and fellowship with him? You see, the tabernacle, if we think back into the Old Testament times, prior to the temple being constructed, there was sort of a tent. And a very large tent. It was designed to very specific parameters, and it housed the Holy of Holies. It housed the tabernacle in it, and the priest they ran it, and they governed how you would approach, and God had laws in the Old Testament, in the Torah, about how you would approach and bring, for example, your sacrifice there. And so it's this tabernacle about which the question is asked, who shall abide in the tabernacle? Well, no one's going to set up camp and live there. That's not the concept. The concept here really is who has the right to approach and remain in the presence of God? Who will dwell in the holy hill? Well, no one's going to move there permanently, but it's the place of God's presence. And so who may stay and dwell and tarry in the very presence of God? And may I say this? I want to read something David would write elsewhere. This is Psalm 27, verse 4. Hear David's words, Psalm 27, 4. One thing, he says, one thing have I desired of the Lord that I will seek after. David says, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. David's heart song was that he could be in fellowship with God for the rest of his days. And certainly David didn't set up camp in the temple. It wasn't built until his son came along, until Solomon. And certainly David didn't set up camp within the tabernacle in his day. Yet he asked this question. That was his longing to be in the house of God all the days of his life. In other words, he didn't want that sense of communion with God when he went to worship, that moment to ever end. That was his heart. And so the question here in Psalm 15 is a question that might be asked as one approaches the tabernacle in worship, and one that we might ask when we approach here and come for corporate worship in church. Who may dwell here? Who may stay here? It's easy for us to come to church on Sunday really and take it for granted. You know, it's not like your right to go into other public places. We can all go into the Burger King. We can all go to the Walmart. There's something different here. If God's presence is here, then this occasion takes on a special significance above all others. And there is something to be said for who has the right to come here. There's an answer here. It's as if in the psalm that the question was asked of God. You see the verse 1, Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? And I think maybe a priest standing by answers the worshiper and says, let me tell you who can abide here. And you begin to get a list beginning in verse 2 of 10 different characteristics of the person who can approach and remain in the presence of God. So look in verse 2. He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart. And I just want to very quickly unpack each of these, but he's going to list 10 of them. The first one is sort of setting the tone for all the other 9 that would follow. One who walks uprightly. Now, consider the negative. Right? If this is what one must do to approach God, then the opposite would prohibit you. You know, someone might have thought, well, I can approach God because I brought my sacrifice. He doesn't say anything about sacrifices in here. Apparently, God is concerned about much more. And in a church, when we approach, I just think it's easy to take it for granted. And it was harder to take it for granted in the ancient days because the Holy of Holies was at one place. And there were priests there, and you couldn't just go in by yourself. And there was a whole lot of rules associated with it. But think about walking uprightly. Walking is just an idiom for how we live. It's all of our acts. It's all of our words. But uprightly means flawlessly. It means perfect. It means blameless. And so the standard's high. And in fact, really, the standard is God's standard. And any worshiper, as soon as they hear the priest say, characteristic number 1, you walk perfectly, maybe I ought to go home. Right? I mean, that's the thing, and yet that's what he says. Jesus, in preaching the Sermon on the Mount, needed to get his disciples to quit thinking in terms of what the Pharisees taught, where everything about righteousness was on the outside. Things had to be on the inside. And so he said, you know, you heard it said of old that you know, a man shouldn't commit adultery, but I tell you, if you lust in your heart. So he flipped everything around. Shouldn't murder, you've heard it said of old, shouldn't murder, but I say, if you have anger in your heart. So he begins to get at that, and then when he gets to the end of chapter 5, after he's done the Beatitudes and he's done all these examples, he says at the end of chapter 5, verse 48, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. The bar just got stuck a little higher than I can jump. And yet, he didn't mean it to be academic. Like, he wanted them to get that there was more than the externality. Something had to enable me to change on the inside to be worthy of having worship. And yet at the same time, he really wanted them, his disciples, to leave the Sermon on the Mount with a resolve to live out their faith. He wasn't trying to say, here's just something you can't do, but I'm going to tell you anyway. He wanted them to be thinking about the fact that they needed Jesus, but also that they need to live a certain way. And that's what's happening here in Psalm 15. Walk uprightly. This is important. So your lifestyle, what you bring to the sanctuary, matters. And if you're bringing anger and bitterness, Jesus talked about that in the New Testament. He said, go to your brother. You've got some issue with your brother, and straighten that out, and then come back and worship. So we see that. We see, secondly, worketh righteousness. I'm just going through the list in verse 15, chapter 15, verse 2. Worketh righteousness. The whole life should be characterized, of course, by doing righteous acts. We're not called to be just, as James would say, hearers of the word, but doers of the word. And so he says, you should have lifestyles characterized by doing righteous deeds. That's what it means to worketh righteousness, to work it out in your daily life. The one acceptable to God is the one that does the will of God, who conforms to his standard, and not merely in thinking about it and saying amen to it, but doing it. And so if someone comes, are they acceptable? Well, are they walking blamelessly? Are they doing outward acts of righteousness? Revelation 19, it's a passage as part of the wedding feast of the Lamb. It's a future event. But I just want you to capture one part of Revelation 19, if you've maybe heard it before, and it's verse 7 and 8. When the wedding of the Son is announced, that the feast is about to begin, and his bride is brought in, it says, to her, to the bride, was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. I think she represents the church. She represents Christians. And the point is, it's not that she's just in fine linen because of Christ, but that she has actually reflected righteous deeds. The church throughout history really has been the mover and shaker of doing that which is right. It's the churches that have set up the orphanages and the universities and the hospitals and stuff, and that, as it should be, the churches who have run the soup lines and tried to give food to the poor, and when we stop doing that, we've missed something. That's not true religion, as James would say. And so it's these acts of righteousness that should characterize the worshiper so that they may not only come to the tabernacle but tarry there. And then the third one, he says in verse 2, speak the truth in his heart. Now, this one cuts pretty deep, to speak the truth in his heart. You know the old saying, my word is my bond. This means that your word is reliable, your word is dependable. Your word actually conforms to reality, because guess what? God's word eternally conforms to reality. Our word ought to conform to reality, not a delusion, not a made-up story, but the way it is. There's more here, though, than it being factually accurate. More here than your words being true, but they actually, it says, comes from the heart. The language there in verse 2, speak the truth in his heart. The words have sincerity to them. You know, the heart is the very center of your emotion, your will, your decisions. And you can say things that may be true, and yet what's in the heart isn't lining up. The sincerity is missing. It's the reason Jesus, in John chapter 1, he would see Nathanael and says, behold, a man in whom is no guile. Like no deceit in his heart. He wasn't talking about the words that came out, but the source of the words, there was no guile. There was no deceit. And so we're talking about no hidden agenda, no half-truths, no deceptive omissions. In our day, the truths become rather fluid, relative. Depends on the circumstances. You know, like a little child, they tell you something and then say, I have my fingers crossed behind my back. Well, that makes it okay. I will accept that from our politicians. It's okay. He had his fingers crossed. Or I swore on a stack of Bibles, but they were all NIVs. It didn't count. It was not a King James in the stack. Will that work? Or, you know, nothing I told you was technically a lie. You bought the car from me, and I told you it never gave me a lick of trouble. I didn't tell you it was my wife's car, and it broke down on her all the time. I never drove the car. Everything I said was technically true. A lot of people think that way. A lot of Christians think that way. I didn't say anything that wasn't true. Yeah, but what you said was deceptive without further information. That's the reality of it. And he says, tell the truth from your heart. You don't tell something. You know, sometimes you can say something that's truthful and you have an agenda. You're manipulating people. A lot of people get through life trying to generate their own, trying to satisfy their own agenda, which usually is getting possessions, getting power, or getting affluence, and they do it through manipulating people around them. And sometimes you can do it by telling the truth, carefully chosen words to the right person at the right time to start manipulating the players on the board. And it ain't right, and that person is not worthy to tarry in the worship of the Lord. James says in chapter 5, verse 12, above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath. He's just pulling directly from what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, because I think he was there. And then he says, but let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation. He says, just tell the truth all the time. It's not a complicated rule. A child can understand that. Tell the truth all the time. And Psalm 15 says, remember what he's listing out. Here's the qualification. So you actually have a right to stand before the very presence of God and worship at the tabernacle. You need to tell the truth from your heart. Look at verse 3 in Psalm 15. He'll continue the list, and he gives items number 4, 5, and 6 that are part of the 10 qualifications for approaching God in worship. Verse 3, he that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh us up a reproach against his neighbor. To backbite with your tongue, he says, you should not be a person who does slander. Slander is one of the very worst things you can do, and it's one of the very easiest things, and it's gotten a lot easier because we have Facebook accounts and Twitter feeds and all these things that make it a lot easier. It's spreading around damaging gossip about people. It's usually untrue. Sometimes it's just unverified. And may I put a note here about verification. in this social media age, if you share information with folks about other folks and you have not verified it and it turns out to be false, you don't get out of jail free because you didn't make it up. You just shared it. Right? The lie is yours. The slander is yours. God holds you accountable for that. And so we need to verify. And if you don't know, don't share it. And if it's, and we'll get to this in a moment, if it's not going to edify somebody, don't share it either. You know, this includes things you say about public figures. Figures you've never met, you don't like them. You didn't vote for them. If I can find something negative, I'm going to share it as many people as I can. I don't think there's an exception in this psalm or anywhere else in the Bible for whether or not they're public figures or not, whether or not you know them or not. If it's designed to bring about harm to a person's reputation, just don't say it. You say, but it was true. And what does that have to do with this? We're talking about your right to come in the presence of God and worship. And he says, if you're a person that's going around slandering folks, you have no right. That's pretty stern words. The second thing that was, let me read a couple of things about slander just real quick, just because you know that the Bible says a great deal about this. In Proverbs 20, verse 19, the writer says, he that goeth about as a talebearer. I love that old word, a talebearer. We don't use that language, but that's what it is. You got a story, and you're carrying it around, and the reality is, and this is so often true, and if this hits somebody, I understand, you're not necessarily a very big person, but I got some information that for a moment in time will get me some attention and just puff me up and make me a foot taller. That's what gossipers do. And the Bible calls them talebearers, and it never has any positive thing to say about these people. And it says, he that goeth about as a talebearer reveals secrets. And they may be true, but sometimes it's good for something to be a secret. There is nothing wrong with you knowing something that no one else knows. Often that's a good thing. The ability to keep a confidence is a sign of maturity. The opposite is a sign of a fool, as he'll say in a moment. He says, therefore, meddle not with him that flattereth with his lips. The people that gossip, the wisdom of God is to have nothing to do with those people. You see them coming? Bolt out, because they're going to bring you something you don't need to know, and it's damaging to someone else. Proverbs 10:18 says, he that hideth hatred with lying lips, and he that uttereth a slander is a fool. And God says, don't have fellowship with fools. Well, as we continue with the fifth item, this is Psalm 15, verse 3. It says, nor doeth evil to his neighbor. Evil is anything that causes your neighbor harm. Righteous people are concerned about those around them. How what I say and what I do affects other people. I don't live on an island, and I can't say I don't care what other people think. I should care. God says I should care. I should care how my actions affect other people. If I do that which is righteous and someone's upset, that's fine. But when I do something that causes harm to other people, that is not a good quality. And being a jerk is neither a macho thing nor a spirit gift. It is something that keeps you from having this access to God that's being talked about here. The fellowship to tarry in the very house of God. So we don't want to be people who cause other people, our neighbor, pain. And we won't ask the question, who's our neighbor? Because Jesus answered that, right? Jesus quoted often or pulled from Leviticus 19:18 that said, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Why? I am the Lord. I get to tell you what to do. That's Leviticus. When Jesus gave the parable, the Good Samaritan, in Luke chapter 10, it ends in verse 36 and 37, which now of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And, of course, the man he's speaking to says, he that showed mercy on him. And then Jesus said, go and do thou likewise. So this is a teaching we know about. Jesus taught affirmatively to do good to our neighbor. Psalm 15 says that's the person that has the right to approach and tarry in the court of God. The next quality, though, is taketh up a reproach. He says, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor. What is a reproach? He says, you don't take up a reproach against your neighbor. That's a taunt. It's a scorn, a sharp criticism. Reproach is a personal attack. May I say, in everyone who's graded solely by their failures will fail. That shouldn't come as a surprise nor seem all that profound. And yet I find that people think that if they grade someone by their failures and they fail, they have proven something of value. You can take our nation. We have some dark hours. We have some warts. And if you group all those together, and you look at how we displaced Native Americans in the 1800s, things like that, and you grade us just by that, we will fail. And the person who does that usually stands up with pride, like they've accomplished something. We will fail. What if you look for those things in people's lives around you for which you could give them an A+? I grant you that you and I have PhDs in picking out other people's eccentricities and faults. But what if we didn't do that and we looked at them for that which we can give them an A+? What if you were a source of encouragement, not reproach? You know, it takes very little wit to taunt, criticize, and bully people. It takes a whole lot more to be a source of encouragement. Okay? But it's a much finer quality. And that's the sort of thing he's talking about. Don't be a reproach to your neighbor. Okay? Now, I realize there's a place for criticism done in the right way, in the right spirit. The proverb says, faithful are the wounds of a friend. But we're talking here in the psalm about that which is mean-spirited, from not a noble motive as helping others, but is simply mean-spirited. Righteous people, those whom share fellowship with the living God, do not trade in the currency of ridicule. We instead promote, we praise, we encourage, we build up. That's what we are. We're builders, not destroyers. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29 says, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. If whatever you're going to say will not minister grace to the hearer, if it will not edify, if there's no reason that they need to know the information, Paul would say, don't say it. Verse 4 of chapter 15, quality 7 and 8, and we'll move a little quickly here. In whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honoreth them that fear the Lord. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. There's two qualities, and I want to unpack them, that there are qualities 7 and 8 listed for the one who can approach the tabernacle of God and tarry there in his presence and enjoy that relationship. And the first listed in verse 4 is really discernment. The ability to distinguish between vile people and righteous people. Why? Because we're casting judgment? No. You know, we pick who we honor in our lives, and sometimes we will glory in those in whom we should not glory. We'll hold up people as some sort of an example of something. The current fallout in Hollywood is just a sign of the fact that people have put great stock and folks who are not worthy of any honor whatsoever, and this is all coming out publicly, and this and that person are being embarrassed. Christians have done that too. Our culture idolizes that which is vile and worthless, crude and perverted. God says here, the person who approaches him is one who's, you know, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honors them that fear the Lord. So we should know the difference between the two. It affects who we'd have fellowship with. And this person isn't just that they know the vile person, but they honor the person who fears God. And we shouldn't look too pious. Many Christians honor people because of what political party they associate with, even though, to use God's word, those people and their conduct and by their words are vile. We ought to be able to call balls and strikes when it comes to those we would publicly honor and hold up as a Christian model of conduct, of righteousness. Somebody I wouldn't be ashamed to say, this is a fellow evangelical. And not take someone that says, well, they ran for such and such office in this party. I'm not going to pay attention to what they do and say. Really? Have some discernment. At least if I'm going to publicly put honor on this person. He goes on and says, he that sweareth to his own hurt. What's he talking about there? You know, it's one thing to take an oath and say that you'll do such and such. And it's another thing to do that. And it's yet another to do that when it actually costs you something. That's an altogether different thing. You see, he says, sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. You agree to do a job. You're a carpenter, a plumber, an electrician, and your bid is to do the job for $1,000. And it turns out it's going to take more work than you thought. And so you spend the equivalent of $1,500 of your time doing it, and you still charge them $1,000. You you've done what he's talking about. You swore to your own hurt. You didn't change your word on it because it became inconvenient, more expensive, or embarrassing for you. You stuck to what you had. And that's what he's talking about. Having integrity even when it costs you. Even when it costs you. Look at verse 5. He that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent. And I'll stop with those two. That's the last two attributes of the person who can tarry in the house of God. Verse 5, he that putteth not out his money to usury. Now, there were some rules in Israel about lending money and whether you could get interest on the money. But what he really has in mind is this idea of lending money to people who are in need and not looking at it as an opportunity for profit. In other words, if I lend you the money and charge you interest, I haven't done you a favor. It's a business transaction. If I lend you the money and then you just pay me back the principal when you were able, I've done something for you that's an act of kindness. There's a difference. And God says, that person that's not looking for the interest, they're doing it because it's an act of kindness, not because it's a business transaction. You know, shrewd business isn't always godly business. That's what he's talking about. And it reveals the heart of the worshiper if they're the type that will loan that money out without expecting interest. It's just something that shows what's on the inside. All of these qualities had nothing to do with bringing the right animal sacrifice. They're all qualities on the inside of the person or how it bubbles out in their righteous acts. The last quality, nor taketh reward against the innocent. Taketh reward against... The reward's money, financial gain against the innocent. We call it bribery in our culture. It's permeated our governments. It's permeated lots of governments. It's even become almost cultural. He says, don't take bribes to, you know, get financial gain and oppress the poor. Corruption, perverting justice for financial gain. And the conclusion to the whole thing is this last part of verse 5. He that doeth these things, all 10 of them, shall never be moved. There's some beautiful language there. There's even a more modern song, I Shall Not Be Moved. He that does these things shall not be moved. Moved from where? Remember the original question? The worshiper approaches the tabernacle of God. The presence of God is there. And we put it in modern terms. We think of coming together for corporate worship at church. We're going to do business with God. And the question is asked, who has the right to really stay in this moment in worshiping and interacting and communing with God? And the Levitical priests list out these 10 fine qualities about walking uprightly and doing good for your neighbor and not doing slander and all that. And then says, the person that does those things shall never be moved. Remember what David wanted? To dwell in the house of the Lord forever? To never be moved. We're talking about obtaining and keeping and maintaining a real fellowship with God. And what the 15th Psalm tells us is you cannot bring a sinful lifestyle to that. God expects us to come clean, as it were. And so the worshiper who does that can stay. So the question, can you come as you are? Not really. The Bible doesn't teach come as you are. Come with reverence. Come with fear. Come mindful of the requirements for approaching a holy God. Righteousness ought to be an inward and outward reality. If it is, if there's a problem in our life, we need to deal with it. That's why the Holy Spirit will prompt us, will convict us of things. We need to deal with it. We cannot force our way into fellowship with God. But following Psalm 15 makes our approach to worship result in something that should be transformative. Because every time we contemplate going to the house of God, and I'm talking about right here at Northwest Baptist Church, we ought to contemplate, God, is there some area in my walk right now I need to fix? Not just before I do the Lord's Supper and participate in that, just coming to church on Sunday at all. To deal with that, to approach a holy God and take our shoes off because we're on holy ground. We had to make reality of that. Hebrews 12:14 says, follow peace with all men in holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Without which no man shall see the Lord. He's talking about a grown-up relationship with God where you come to really understand him on a deeper level because of your fellowship. Follow peace with all men in holiness, without which no man will see the Lord.